The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The stronger, smarter position and the position that better respects the appropriate balance of separation of powers is from the outset to say, this is the information we have. These are the inferences we are making. We believe we are entitled to this information as a constitutional matter. It's part of our constitutionally assigned function of impeachment. For the executive branch to refuse to produce it is obstruction, and we are going to treat it as such. And I think any sort of moderated position of that, the executive branch essentially wins by default, especially if they're willing to engage in the kinds of gamesmanship that we've seen. And so I do think it's an area in which kind of playing the middle game of sort of litigating it through is a position that could get them in a really sticky, counterproductive situation very, very quickly.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 6th, 2019. It's not quite an emergency podcast because it's not quite an emergency, but it's another week of impeachment stuff. And we thought it warranted getting everybody around a table to talk about it. So joining me in the Jungle Studio are Margaret Taylor, David Priest, Susan Hennessy, and Scott Anderson, the Lawfare core editorial staff, minus the ones who aren't here. We talked about the Schiff report. We talked about the Nunes-Jordan pre-rebuttal report. We talked about the hearing Wednesday in the House Judiciary Committee with a lot of law professors that went on for a really long time. And we talked about Nancy Pelosi's message to the troops Thursday afternoon that impeachment was going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 481, another week of impeachment. I want to start with a really important question, which is how to categorize this podcast, because it's not an emergency podcast because we're recording on Thursday and it's not going to run till Friday, but it's not a normal podcast either. It's kind of we gathered everybody together for the, you know, on a kind of urgent basis. So what do we call it?
So it's not quite an emergency podcast. Is it at least an urgency podcast?
We could implement the George W. Bush terror alert color coding system.
So which color listeners. Would this, what color would this
like
be?
Like an aubergine.
All right.
As a colorblind person, I do have to formally object.
Or what about like a climate, you know, in cities they have those sort of haze meters. So it could be like, you know, hazy, like a political outlook is hazy.
Wow. All right. I think aubergine seems like a lot, a mouthful for this. So I think we're going to go, but I like the terror alert model. So
I think orange is technically the middle.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just go with
like hazy orange.
It's an orange alert podcast. We're recording Thursday afternoon and a whole boatload of stuff has happened. I'm not sure anything has changed as a result of any of it, but let's get into it. Margaret, so the first big thing that happened was that Adam Schiff released the Schiff report. To what extent does it change anything or refine anything in your mind about any of this?
So having read all of the transcripts and watched all the hearings, nothing in it surprised me exactly. And I think the narrative, broadly speaking, of the story that it tells is just broadly consistent with sort of my familiarity with all of this stuff. There was some more specific records and description of interactions with OMB, though, which I don't remember being part of the public testimony. So that was interesting. There were some phone records in there, records of phone calls between Giuliani and OMB, between Giuliani and an unidentified number, which some are speculating is the president's cell phone. So all of that was sort of a new element for me that's included in the Schiff report, and actually really interesting, I think, because we don't have all the answers about what all of that means.
What did you guys, other than Margaret, think of the Schiff report? To what extent was this the presentation you were expecting from Adam Schiff? To what extent was it different in any meaningful sense? Scott?
It really was what I was expecting in a way. And we had talked about this, I think, a week or two earlier, which is that it was a two-part product. The first part is an executive summary that tries to tell a pretty clear story, bring together a summary narrative of the facts as we know them. And then they have their closing statement, their effort to take all the different pieces that they've elicited through testimony, introduce some new pieces through other evidence that hadn't been made public previously, like the phone records, and then knit it together into a longer, thoroughly documented, heavily footnoted narrative that would withstand factual scrutiny. And I found it on that front, if you take the time to go through it all, and I've gone through most of it, I won't claim to have dug into every single footnote and page, it's pretty thorough and it's pretty careful. An interesting point is that they're careful not to quite to go so far as to say definitively the president conditioned military assistance. They say people were worried about it. They say the president reacted after they stepped back. But instead, they really tie it much more explicitly to the White House meeting. The rest, they accept that there's a level of inference there because they didn't have as direct testimony on that particular point. Sondland hedged a little bit. And no one else was able to step in fully. And I think, again, they're trying to go about this in a careful, meticulous way that shows this report, which runs a little bit contrary to some of the accusations we've seen against them by House Republicans and some of their witnesses this week.
Susan, how careful did you think it managed to be? Where do you think it was? You said on Rational Security yesterday that it was a little bit less careful than the Mueller report. I'm curious for your sense of the degree of care relative to what you expected here.
Yeah, so I think it's clearly less careful than the Mueller report. I agree with Scott that they do make some sort of distinctions regarding the conditioning of military aid versus the White House meeting. That said, you know, it's designed to be a persuasive document. It's a document that does include logical inferences, reasonable logical inferences, but still logical inferences in a way that doesn't very, very clearly sort of set aside, okay, here's the undisputed, uncontested facts. Here's the area in which we're actually making an argument. So I don't think it was it certainly was far more careful than 99.9% of congressional reports, which tend to be not at all cautious or careful documents. So I think it was a pretty disciplined document. That said, it was not a document that was designed to set forth the genuine uncontested facts in a way that all parties were going to accept. It was intended to be a persuasive messaging document. And I think really it was intended to be a document that united the narrative in one place and in a place that felt relatively clean and clear. And I think that's one area in which the Democrats are still struggling a little bit. And this is a little bit like what we saw happen sort of post-Mueller. And that's that it's kind of a complicated story. There's a couple different moving pieces. It's hard to get people to sort of read a 300-page document. It's hard to get them to read a 30-page executive summary. And so I think it was really, really designed to have sort of this narrative clarity to the story. And I think it did that well internally. That said, I haven't yet seen the evidence that the Schiff report sort of helped transmit the fundamental story to the public, and it's getting that kind of pickup and it's being sort of accepted for that narrative clarity. And that's something that might come a little bit more with time. But I think that's still a really, really crucial thing that needs to happen. And I'm not sort of seeing that leap quite yet.
Shifty Schiff report fails so far to produce Schiff.
Ooh, try saying that 10 times fast. Let me build on what Susan said, because two things struck me that really parallel those. One is in reading this, just how readable it is. Its style is different than the Mueller report. It is not recitation of fact. It is a persuasive document, and it's written in that way. So credit to the poor staffers who probably stayed up night after night writing this and still coming out with a very digestible document. That said, even though looking at it as a piece of rhetoric, it's relatively effective, I was surprised at its sheer length. I realized they wanted to include a lot of information to transmit over, but to the extent they were looking to it to be a document to be read by the general public, it's not going to be read. We all learned that with the Mueller report, when in fact we had to do the podcast, The Report, to get a message out about it to a lot of people who otherwise would not read something that was over 100 pages. That said, and this is my second point, I'm not sure that was the goal. I'm not sure they really care whether the public reads this report. This was intended to be the connective tissue between the work that they trusted Adam Schiff to do efficiently and effectively in the Intel Committee, knowing that they couldn't have the whole impeachment take place in the Intel Committee because of the screams that would go up about that. They had to get this to judiciary. This was a way of doing that by communicating the fact and the findings of the Intel Committee hearings in a way that did it relatively quickly and didn't lose momentum. In that, I think it succeeded.
All right. So this was only one of two reports that happened this week. The Republican response, which actually predated the Schiff report. It came out, I guess it's a pre-response. I'm not
pre-buttal.
A pre-buttal. Also came out. It was subject to some ridicule. I am actually a little bit less contemptuous of it than some people are. I thought the Republican staff had a terrible case to work with and did a reasonably good job with a bad case, making the least embarrassing arguments that were available to them. Margaret, tell me how am I wrong? If you were Mr. Castor, how would this document have been better?
I'm not sure it could have been better. The thing that struck me about it was that it wasn't sort of just some recitation of a bunch of conspiracy theories, which, you know, you can imagine that being a product that could
no,
be created.
It was construction of the record.
Yeah. And you know, I do think that it basically said, you know, there's just not enough evidence to show any of these things. And, you know, the president didn't really do anything wrong. It just sort of makes those conclusions and does draw from the actual witness testimony to support some of those points. And so in that way, it was sort of a reasonable document. But I think the problem is that for someone who has followed this whole thing, it does seem to sort of willfully or, you know, just sort of ignore a bunch of things that were pretty straightforward in the whole record of the depositions and the testimony. And so in that sense, it read to me more kind of like what a defense attorney does in a criminal case in closing arguments, just sort of pointing out the holes and, you know, trying to draw the jury over to another conclusion, even though, I just didn't find it very convincing personally.
You know, that said, I had a similar reaction when I first sort of read it. Having spent a little bit more time with it now, I actually am less charitable about it. I don't actually think it is similar to what a defense attorney wrote. In part because I don't think it's a document that a lawyer, even a defense attorney, could submit into the record in court, because the document contains outright lies and no willful, clear distortions of fact.
So what's an example of that?
I didn't bring in like my list of things, but essentially it is a degree of cherry picking and of saying there is no evidence to support X, Y, and Z. Look at this evidence, which doesn't support X, Y, and Z, not acknowledging all of the evidence that exists, right? It is a distortion that I think exceeds that which, for example, the federal judiciary would tolerate without imposing some kind of sanction. And so, you know, I on one hand, yes, it's reassuring that it's not a full sort of conspiracy theory document, although there are some sort of shadings of conspiracy theory that are in it. It does use the record, but it uses the record in a manner that is really, really fundamentally dishonest. And you can tell that it's not a document that is sure of itself, because they aren't willing to concede anything. They aren't willing to concede if this had happened, it would be bad, but it didn't happen, right? They don't actually trust the record. They don't trust the president. So they say there would be nothing wrong if it happened. It would be totally fine if it happened. It didn't happen, and the record didn't support that it did happen, right? And so it's sort of held together with kind of duct tape and gum, and I think it's designed to look plausible and serious on its face, but it fundamentally is really not a serious piece of work. And so that's why I am interested to sort of see when we have the final confrontation, either whether that comes in sort of the judiciary hearings where the various councils will produce the reports, or if it comes in the Senate trial, whether or not the weakness of it and sort of the inability to counter even the most just apparent damning facts, that really will sort of fall apart for them.
So Scott, do you think this document is the Senate defense, or do you think Trump's defense will be based on some other theory?
I think we're going to see a defense a lot like this when it comes down to the actual facts. But it's two parts, right? You have an executive summary for this document that really is attacking the process. It's their distraction strategy. It's been what we've heard Nunes do in the introduction to every witness, where it talks about the corruption of the process, the fact there are witnesses they won't let them call, things like that. And only at the very end does it really dig into its rebuttal of the facts. And it's pretty scant in the summary. Then they go through a long effort here, and they make a lot of assertions where essentially they are construing every possible inference in the light most favorable to the president, straining credibility on a number of fronts. I would agree with Susan on that front. That is a lot like what defense attorneys do. Defense attorneys say they rest on burden. They say, all I have to do is prove a reasonable doubt, and if there's a reasonable doubt, I win. And so I'm going to attack every angle of the prosecution's case in an effort to poke one hole, and that's enough. The difference here, though, is that it's not a reasonable doubt standard. That's not clearly the standard. It's not clear what standard really applies in the question of impeachment. It's kind of up for the Congress to decide, in a way, each legislator to decide what is the appropriate threshold. And so it's not clear to me that this carries across here. But I do think that's where they've landed. They're going to try and attack every angle and just seed enough doubt throughout in the record. And to some extent, that's all they really can do. I agree with Susan. They may not do that super confidently. They're really resting still on this distraction and process arguments, I think, because they're not super confident of their ability to do that. But it's still a big part of their strategy now. We've seen them shift towards attacking the record where they can, however they can.
Look, there is one really important concession to that point, though, and that's that the Republicans do concede that investigations into Burisma are investigations into Biden, and they just are apparent in that. And that's really important because if we saw the strategy of people like Gordon Sondland and Kurt Volker, who refused to make that connection in their testimony as if they didn't know. They knew the president wanted investigations into Burisma, but they didn't realize that that had anything to do with Biden. That was actually really critical to them being able to sort of maintain their own lack of culpability in it. And so it is really interesting that Republicans are not even going to try and go down that road. And I do think it is the one of the sort of significant concessions.
But David, if you were the Republican counsel here.
Why are you doing this to me?
You know, we all have to go through this.
Let me put myself in that mental space.
It's lawfare, David. Law.
I would be very concerned to write off this record because I know Mick Mulvaney hasn't testified and I know John Bolton hasn't testified. And if you say if this had happened, it would be impeachable, you're going to find out 2 weeks from now that that's exactly what happened, right? And so I want to suggest that, Mr. Castor is just being prudent in having a layered defense in which this didn't happen. And by the way, if it did, it was a perfect phone call. And even if it was imperfect, it was still, fine. And even if it wasn't fine, it wasn't impeachable, right? Like, shouldn't they believe the record is unstable?
I read it similarly. In looking at this, I thought, this isn't for us. This is an assemblage of talking points to give to members who are being asked about it, and they can't run away from the microphone fast enough, so they have to say something. So there's the long list of all of these assertions, like U.S. foreign aid is often conditioned or paused, and U.S. security assistance to Ukraine has been paused before. Okay, that is true. U.S. foreign aid is often conditioned, and there's a process to go through those conditions, which had happened in this case before the president's intervention. Some of them are just outright wrong, especially, as you point out, if new testimony does come to light. For example, the idea that, and this is in the Republican report, the Ukrainian government understood that Mayor Giuliani was not speaking on behalf of President Trump. Oh, really? You know, I'd like to ask Mayor Giuliani about that. And if he does talk, are they going to have to walk back so many of these talking points that it unravels the rest of the case within?
But isn't that in the category of outright lie? Whenever they say the Ukrainians didn't believe Giuliani was representing Trump, the president of the United States mentioned Rudy Giuliani in his call. State Department officials put Rudy Giuliani in contact with Ukrainian officials. Gordon Sondland repeatedly communicated that fact. And so that's one of the areas that, to me, if we're thinking about what would a court tolerate if you submitted something like that into the record, that is not exactly spin or light most favorable. That is a lie.
100%. And that's why I read this as talking points for members, not a formal case being made, because somebody can say that and have it quoted on Fox News, and there's no consequence to that. For that purpose, maybe it actually accomplished its goal. It's a very weak goal. It's a very low bar that they were trying to clear. But if you were simply trying to put out there as many points that people could respond to legitimate questions on, here are some of those talking points, even if some of them are at least disingenuous.
All right. So third thing that happens this week is yesterday's big marathon law professor hearing, which raised will to live issues for certain of us. But Susan, what did it contribute to the larger discussion?
Oh, God.
If anything.
I mean, nothing really. Nothing substantively. It contributed some sort of soundbite talking points to the American public of like the role of impeachment in the constitutional system. And for people who watched it, it probably was sort of a reasonable education on, the role and purpose of impeachment in a constitutional system. That said, I thought it was a pretty undisciplined hearing. It was a hearing that certainly made me concerned about kind of the strategy and discipline of the Judiciary Committee moving forward. And ultimately, I think it was a win for the Republicans in a really important way. And that's that the Republican witness, Jonathan Turley, someone who I think we just have to acknowledge is really, really being intellectually dishonest and dishonest with his own positions. This is someone who not only supported the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, but sort of presented himself as this kind of apolitical, nonpartisan, non-Trumpist guy. You know, this is somebody who has throughout Trump's tenure kind of provided legal support and clearly is a political actor and was not representing, I think, in good faith, even his own views of the subject. And I'll be candid on sort of that point. That said, he did a really good job of acting as though this is just a question on which reasonable minds can differ. And we have these big constitutional questions, and I really respect my colleagues. But and the substantive points he was making were nonsense, right? The idea that there's a requirement to sort of seek remedy to the courts and that somehow is part of the process. It's just factually false. He's just making this up. The idea that there's some sort of obligation, there's a time dimension, you know, that's sort of necessary here. Again, like that's just your opinion and sort of trying to sort of root this in the founding is absurd. The idea that bribery requires the statutory elements, that can't possibly be true because bribery is written in the Constitution and the Constitution comes before at least the passage of statutes in question. And so that said, I think a person watching that who didn't have all of that background and didn't have the background of who he was would think, well, these are like very nice law professors who are debating with one another. And maybe this really is a question on which like people can look at the record and say like, I don't love that the president did this, but it really doesn't rise to impeachment. I think that was the fundamental goal and task was to provide cover for the uncomfortable Republicans. And so, you know, I think Michael Gerhardt's sort of ending where he said, if this is not impeachable. Nothing is impeachable. That was the critical point that really needed to come out of that hearing. And I think the overall takeaway that a lot of people got, and not just Fox News watchers, but was kind of like, this is a big, wide-ranging academic debate, and who really knows where the reality falls. And for that, I have to say, I think the Republicans gained a lot from that hearing.
Margaret, so, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I guess I had a slightly different impression. I think that for Americans who have not really been paying attention to all of this stuff going on and Adam Schiff and the Intelligence Committee, but who may have perked up at this step in the process of it getting more serious and moving to the Judiciary Committee, I think it was a pretty, as Susan, as you said, also the, you know, pretty decent civics lesson for Americans tuning in. It did surprise me a little bit. I just wasn't expecting these law professors, particularly the first three, to kind of be as definitive as they were. I was expecting a little bit more sort of a more general review of the Constitution and what high crimes and misdemeanors is, what bribery meant to the founding fathers. But instead, they were actually pretty forward-leaning on, you know, this is definitely impeachable conduct. So I was a little bit sort of surprised to see it. Not that I don't think it's warranted. I just thought it was an interesting sort of it gave it a different spin than I thought it would be. I thought it would be actually sort of more boring and dry. Regarding Professor Turley, what I took away from his presentation is that his main point seemed to be that, you know, there might be impeachable acts here, but gee, there hasn't been enough time and attention and hearings and investigation to really establish that, which just seems a little bit odd to me, because it's not clear to me that Republicans necessarily want for, you know, these hearings to drag on and on, for people like Mick Mulvaney and Mike Pompeo to be sort of compelled to come up and testify. So it just was like an interesting sort of tension, I thought, that he was saying, you know, there might be something here, but gee, we just don't know yet. This process should slow way down and should be much more fulsome, which is just sort of an interesting message at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, I really took Turley's argument as being a policy argument. It is really not a legal argument. He concedes the following. He concedes that you can impeach a president for non-criminal offenses, for abuses of power. He concedes that there doesn't appear to be much of a legitimate policy basis for at least the request for investigation of the Bidens, although he says we can't definitively prove that, you know, the president at this point wasn't trying to, you know, address a act of corruption that wasn't adequately addressed by the Obama administration. That's, I think it's one of the stretchier parts of his willing to make an inference in the benefit of the president. But he does this repeatedly through his testimony, where he makes the case saying, here are the ways we could read this in the light most favorable to the president. And he puts the burden on those favoring impeachment to disprove that. He says, well, you should be calling these witnesses like John Bolton and like Mitch Mulvaney to try and get them to testify, who can actually testify to the president's actions and motivations. And if they are unwilling to, as the president says, you should go to the courts and fight that out. What you shouldn't be doing is moving to impeachment and making a case where you're relying on inferences, you're relying on other sorts of evidence that, let's be honest and let's be clear, are part of the judicial system, do come up in criminal and civil litigation all the time. But he's saying you shouldn't rely on that because abuse of power is such a fungible standard. It would create a dangerous precedent for future Congresses that they could then wield as a sword against subsequent presidents anytime the president did something they didn't like. There's no reason Congress really has to buy into that sort of standard. Oh, I should also say, he also says for abuse of power requires a quid pro quo. He doesn't give any legal support for that, or frankly, any historical practice for that. He kind of pulls it out of thin air. And it's pretty clear it doesn't. You know, if the president unilaterally bombed a competitor hotel overseas, that would be an impeachable abuse of power. It doesn't require a quid pro quo necessarily.
Probably also be a war crime.
Not to mention a few other problems with that. Absolutely. So it doesn't strictly require a quid pro quo. And, you know, it served the Republicans' purpose here. You know, he is a witness who they can plausibly say, and I think this is important for the media cycle, I think it's too bad House Democrats didn't pursue this. They can plausibly say this is a Democratic or Democrat leaning. He says, I vote Democrat. I voted for Obama. A law professor saying this doesn't go this well. This doesn't reach the level of impeachment. And that gives the sound bites that the Republicans want. And frankly, Turley sound bites have, at least from the media I listen to, dominated the scene afterwards. In that sense, it was a little bit, I think, of a Republican win. That said, they have now had the witness, their only witness on the legal basis, concede a lot of ground. And it could come back to bite them to some extent. But to do so, to get there, would have to have them, you know, chase down additional facts, bring in additional information. And they don't seem inclined to do that because they do want to keep this quick pace and resolve this so it doesn't get in the way of potential election.
All right. But I am hung up on an antecedent point, which is, why does it matter what four law professors think about this? I mean, I look at it and I say, this bothered me during the Clinton impeachment when there were like 16 or 17 law professors who were – one of them was Jonathan Turley, by the way. And they were kind of like lined up in four panels all expressing their feelings about impeachment. And, you know, since the words of the Constitution are reasonably well understood as to what does treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors mean, there's some argument around the edges of it, but there's not a huge amount of argument. What is the value, David, of, you know, lining up law professors to kind of wag their fingers at us about, you know, their deep emotional connections with the founders and what that says about whether the current president should be impeached or not?
I think there were two points to it. One of them is simply what you pointed out. This was done in the Clinton impeachment. That is within the living memory, not only of much of the American public, but some senators and representatives were there at the time. So let's repeat that process to make this seem less unique because of Trump. So there's that. Secondly, in order to disarm the political narrative of the Democrats have wanted to impeach Donald Trump since day one, which actually is a lie because there were voices saying we should impeach Donald Trump before the election if he were to be elected. So it's even before that. You might say it's a negative one day of the impeachment.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Phone records.
To me, that was really the point here is, yes, it's a speed bump in the relatively rapid progress of the Schiff hearings going to judiciary. But it's a speed bump that the networks covered, and that allowed the Democrats to put out there, look, we are not doing this because we are anti-Trump and we're looking for a reason. We're doing this because we have some reasonable constitutional scholars. I think Michael Gerhardt also testified back in the 1998 hearings. We have some people who have written extensively about impeachment, and they will tell you that, yes, things like abuse of power and other things generally are what are considered high crimes and misdemeanors. This is what the founders meant when they debated in 1787 about impeachment overall and the need for it. By having just one day of that, they, in a sense, disarmed the argument that they were rushing towards impeachment politically without grounding it in the very constitutional reasons for it. Now, I think there was a mistake there, which has been alluded to here, and I will refer to the article that Molly Reynolds and Margaret Taylor — it's odd to talk about you in the third person when I'm sitting next to you.
Feel free.
But that Molly and Margaret had in Lawfare talking about this moving to the Judiciary Committee, we saw that. As Susan pointed out, the dynamics were very different here, and it allowed this false equivalence to come out in a way that I fear is a preview of what will happen going forward because of the relative unruliness of the Judiciary Committee compared to the fairly strict, with some exceptions, the fairly strict running of the Intel Committee. So in a sense, this was a bit of a preview of what we'll get as they move forward. That's the more disturbing element because the clear narrative coming out of the earlier hearings was a net positive for pointing out why this is impeachable behavior.
That said, I actually do think one thing that this hearing did was clarify the necessity of having an article of impeachment related to Mueller. And that's because an article of impeachment based on the most serious accusations of obstruction of justice in the Mueller report actually are clear rejoinders to kind of the core argument, the two core arguments here. One, that there was insufficient factual development of a record. Clearly, that's not the case following the Mueller investigation, two, that there weren't sufficient statutory, like the statutory elements of a crime had not been met. That is that clearly exists. And so just putting in a Mueller obstruction of justice for the direction to John McGahn, and the direction both to fire Robert Mueller and then to create a false internal record denying that story, that's a very, very strong, well-supported case. And so just by including it, I think basically you can take that argument away from the Republicans by saying, well, if that's really what you believe, then don't vote for these other articles, but you better vote for this one because this satisfies all of the questions that you're raising right now.
And notably, they are litigating out the McGahn testimony. So it is one area where they're doing what Turley says they failed to do elsewhere, pursuing a remedy through the courts.
Right. So Before we move on, I want to raise one issue that relates to Turley's complaint that I would be worried about if I were the Democrats. It's not a legal question. It's a prudential litigation question. So if you are going to litigate this in the Senate and you're the House impeachment managers or somebody expecting to be one, like, say, Jerry Nadler or Adam Schiff or both, and you are going to have to call Don McGahn and you're going to have to call Mick Mulvaney and you're going to have to call John Bolton because there's, you know, and I think you're likely to get them in the Senate and you're likely to get them in public testimony, having never interviewed them before and having no idea what they're going to say. And that strikes me as immensely strategically disadvantageous. And so my question, Margaret, is wouldn't it, like, if not for reasons complete, if only for reasons completely different from the ones that Turley advances, wouldn't it be better to have that closed-door deposition now, accept the delay, litigate the thing, get it done, get Don McGahn's cert denial done, have him so that you know what all these people are going to say before you go and interview them blind in a Senate trial? And by the way, Mick Mulvaney will bob and weave, and John Bolton is at least as smart as the people who will be interviewing him. Isn't that a dangerous situation from a litigation point of view?
I mean, I think in theory, you're right. If sort of House Democrats had their druthers, they probably would have these people in and depose them. But the literally months-long process that they would have to go through potentially to get that done, I mean, remember, the subpoena for, I believe the subpoena or the lawsuit for Don McGahn was back in May. I mean, it has literally been months.
But it won't be months the second time. I mean, so once you have the McGahn precedent and you waive that in John Bolton, and I think we're days away from resolution on McGahn, assuming the Supreme Court doesn't want to hear it. If it does want to hear it, that's a whole different picture. But let's say they decline to hear the matter. Then you have an on-point D.C. Circuit opinion. You waive it in Mick Mulvaney's face. You waive it in John Bolton's face. They're going to defy a subpoena under those circumstances?
I just don't know. I mean, I know the president almost certainly would direct them to. So I just don't know the answer. And I'm not sure that House Democrats do either. And I think one of the keys for House Democrats is like keeping whatever momentum they have going, and doing what they can in the, I think, politically sort of short amount of time that they have. It's not clear to me, actually, that their heads at this point are quite wrapped around all of the strategies that they're going to need to deploy in the Senate in order to be successful. In addition, if they did bring those lawsuits now, I do think that opponents can say, well, we can't impeach now. We can't move forward. We have to wait until these things get sorted out in the courts. And so I think they're trying to not be drawn into that particular trap. Whether it bites them in the end on the Senate side, it's a good question.
And I think it is a timing issue because, first of all, let's not pretend that Nancy Pelosi hasn't thought through this and done the strategy on this. Yes, I think you're right. Maybe waving that in the face of a Bolton or a Pompeo will change their mind, but you can't bet on it. And if not, then you're looking not at a December, January, February timeframe for articles of impeachment moving to a trial. You might be looking at June, July, August. It is as likely as not that the presidential or vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party will be a U.S. senator. They are required to attend the trial. This is during the heart of campaign season. Pelosi has to have that on her mind, as well as the issue of momentum. We saw what happened when the Mueller report lost its momentum within a matter of weeks. Basically, people forgot about it and said, we can't even add those to articles of impeachment. Not everyone's saying that, but many people have put that out there. The same thing happens here. I think that is Pelosi's fear.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I think what David Margaret spot out is right in terms of this trade-off. And this is really what Turley got at in his testimony. And there's some validity there a little bit. Now, he says, look, we shouldn't be doing this because abuse of power impeachment is, again, too open a concept. You're setting a dangerous precedent for people in the future, kicking the doors open. I don't necessarily buy that. You know, in this case, the House has to make a case at a certain point. There's infinite – you could continue to develop a case into infinity in any given case. They invite to the point where they think they've got a strong case for impeachment, and they seem to have gotten there. And they have to take other factors into account in terms of their agenda, political considerations, things like that. So I don't think there's anything illegitimate about what the Democrats are doing. But there is a trade-off here. You have political costs. And you are adopting a little bit of a weaker case here. The other angle I do think needs to be brought in, where I do think Turley has a point, is that in choosing not to pursue these other witnesses through subpoenas or through litigation, it does narrow the scope of a potential – I think should at least narrow the scope of potential obstruction of justice, article of impeachment, as it relates to those witnesses. If I were the Democrats, I'd be very hesitant to adopt an article saying that refusing to let them testify when you haven't pursued it through a subpoena even or litigation for those witnesses is itself a basis for impeachment. You think back to Fast and Furious, where you saw a similar debate. You could see future Congresses use that against Democratic presidents and say, well, yeah, you may think you have a legitimate executive privilege assertion, but we think you don't, and we don't have to wait for the courts to speak out that matter. So there's something a little bit – if they waited and were able to pursue this out, they could have a stronger case for obstruction of justice if they refused to let these people testify.
But Scott, wouldn't that be a stronger argument if there were actual assertions rather than a blanket statement, we're defying all the subpoenas, and a letter that says we don't recognize Congress's general oversight authority because we have a sort of unilateral authority to decide ourselves whether Congress's interests are legitimate?
I agree. I mean, like, if you're going to do it, the White House has put itself out on enough of a peninsula of a distinguishable case for future White Houses by issuing that pretty absurd Cipollone letter and the logic behind it. That said, you know, I got to be honest, it still makes me a little bit nervous. You know, how do you distinguish a refusal to testify there from something that isn't as embedded in such ludicrous rhetoric and kind of facetious legal arguments when they haven't quite issued the subpoena yet? Again, I don't think there's any obligation on the part of the House Democrats, if they think they can make their case of impeachment without it, to issue those subpoenas. But I do think it limits what you can argue in terms of obstruction of justice from an impeachment perspective.
I mean, like, the alternative might be issuing subpoenas and then relying on inherent contempt authority to actually attempt to enforce them rather than sort of relying on the courts as an initial matter. That said, I'm far less concerned about the idea that this is a slippery slope, in part because it's sort of the equivalent of, you know, somebody asserting, like an ordinary defendant in court, you know, asserting, you know, some limited constitutional right versus a sovereign citizen that declines to acknowledge the validity of the jurisdiction of the United States of America, right? The idea that in those circumstances the appropriate course is to litigate that out as if it's a good faith thing, that's not what's happening, right? It's a sort of an outright assault on the concept of separation of powers. And so I do think that in those circumstances it is different in kind. And so the idea that, well, somebody down the road will pretend that it's not different in kind, I'm less concerned about that because I think the risks of allowing him to get away with it and of teaching presidents that this is something that's valid and a strategy that can actually work in the face of really, really significant wrongdoing, so long as you have a majority essentially in the Senate, I think the risks of that are way worse than the risks of the counterproposition.
Just so really quickly, something that Susan said reminded me. The House Intelligence Committee did subpoena a bunch of these people that we are talking about. And what Adam Schiff did when those people did not show up for the appointed time of their deposition, including people like Mick Mulvaney and something like 12 other people, what he did was he got down into the, you know, the skiff or whatever where they were doing these depositions, and he records for each of them a pretty long, you know, soliloquy almost saying, you know, here's why this person's testimony is important, here's why we called them, here's the data subpoena, they entered into the record. And he specifically in each of these, you know, transcripts says, you know, and we reserve the right in future proceedings to, you know, use this as evidence of contempt of Congress. And so Adam Schiff has laid the record for what you said, Susan, of sort of this other process of, you know, this more direct executive legislative conflict as opposed to going to the courts.
I mean, I think that's right. But again, the underlying question of what the scope of the substantive right is between Congress and the executive branch is something that's open for judicial resolution. And, you know, Congress simply asserting its vision of that as a basis for impeachment without resorting to the courts does raise this kind of difficult question about, like, well, what is the way that we adjudicate these conflicts between these branches? Up until now, it's been through an accommodation process under the threat of judicial pressure of resolution. Even if you use inherent contempt authority, I'm not sure – I don't know if there's enough case law on this, but I'd be shocked if there's not a resolution to a habeas basis or other judicial means of remedy that would, again, bring the courts in. So it still raises the threats. Now, I'm not saying that that means that – I don't agree with Turley that that undermines impeachment. You've got to weigh that risk against the risk of – allowing a president to do this sort of behavior without any realistic check, right? There's a very, very strong interest on the other side that has to be balanced. In terms of specifically, you know, a obstruction of justice impeachment on this specific issue, I still think it makes me a little nervous, even if they have laid the foundation for it, which agreed Schiff definitely did. And I would note just about the sovereign citizen litigation, the Justice Department does actually rebut those claims for a reason. For rule of law reasons, even though they do it pretty summarily.
What this points out to me is that they are balancing the need for a very strong, robust set of articles on abuse of power and obstruction of justice versus having what they had in the Nixon impeachment, which is having a strong article of impeachment on contempt of Congress. Remember, that article of impeachment said that Nixon had failed without lawful cause or excuse to produce papers and things directed by duly authorized subpoenas issued by the Committee on the Judiciary. As Margaret pointed out, you just substitute the word intelligence. And you've got, in a sense, a contempt of Congress article of impeachment. Now, what's the value of that versus actually getting Mulvaney and Pompeo, maybe Pence, to testify and having a really strong abuse of power or having them refuse to testify even after getting more subpoenas? I think that's a reasonable calculation for them to make in terms of how they're going to move forward with actual articles.
I just want to say I think this problem is going to take care of itself. And the reason is that we're going to hear from the Supreme Court within a very short period of time about whether they're hearing this case or not. And while a cert denial
– You mean the McGahn case?
The McGahn case. Yeah. And while a cert denial is non-precedential and doesn't stand for anything, it does leave in place – a very strong D.C. Circuit opinion on the subject. And so if you at that point continue to take the position we are defying all the subpoenas, you are then doing it in the face of on-point controlling opinions, which I then think gives an impeachment article on obstruction of Congress a very different sheen. On the other hand, if the Supreme Court were to say, we want to hear this and we think the president has likelihood success on the merits, so we're going to, you know, have a stay in place, well, then it begins to look like you're impeaching him for asserting entertainable legal entitlements and privileges in front of a court that wants to hear them.
But then what about if you do win and you get people to come in on you know, to respond to the subpoena, and then they assert overbroad executive privilege to prevent you from getting the substantive answer, something I think we are likely to see in the case of both Don McGahn and Mick Mulvaney, then you're back in the exact same loop of litigation upon litigation to get the information. And that's why I think strategically the stronger, smarter position and the position that better respects the appropriate balance of separation of powers is from the outset to say, this is the information we have. These are the inferences we are making. We believe we are entitled to this information as a constitutional matter. It's part of our constitutionally assigned function of impeachment. For the executive branch to refuse to produce it is obstruction, and we are going to treat it as such. And I think any sort of moderated position of that, the executive branch essentially wins by default, especially if they're willing to engage in the kinds of gamesmanship that we've seen. And so I do think it's an area in which kind of playing the middle game of sort of litigating it through is a position that could get them in a really sticky, counterproductive situation very, very quickly.
I mean, the timing thing is really difficult here. That's certainly true. And they're certainly true you're going to see an additional fight moving forward. But, I mean, look, this is the process we saw play out in the Nixon inquiry, right? We saw litigation over these things. That's what led to the release of – led to the decision saying it's, you know, a qualified sort of privilege. It's not an absolute privilege. And that's what led ultimately to the release of Nixon tapes. And, you know –
That was not a congressional subpoena.
No, agreed. It's a little bit different. But nonetheless, you saw that sort of process through the courts that ultimately forced them to disclose a sort of really damaging information. I don't think we should assume that there's – you couldn't get a judicial resolution at some point in, you know, our lifetimes in the next year to actually disclose some substantial information, even over assertions of executive privilege, particularly when you get the courts to confirm again that it is qualified, not absolute. And so, you know, I agree with you. I take your point, and I think you have to take the political factors into consideration, which are driving a lot of this. But, you know, I'm not sure all the things being equal, it wouldn't be a much stronger case still pursuing this through the courts and trying to get some sort of resolution.
All right. This brings me with a brief matter of personal disclosure to our final issue. For a brief matter of personal disclosure is when I was a very young reporter at a local trade newspaper called Legal Times. There was this young law professor who was doing these really interesting litigations at the nexus of environmental law and national security law. And he was super nice to me, and I gave him a lot of favorable press coverage, and his name was Jonathan Turley. So I watch him in these settings with a little bit of a head scratch going on. Not really the guy I thought I knew. Which brings me to Nancy Pelosi, who this morning gave a press conference in a brief press statement in which she said we were moving on with impeachment. And David, what did she say and how do you read it?
Given all the other news this week, it seems like an afterthought of this press conference, but it really was interesting to see what she did do and what she did not do. First, she very explicitly tied this, as the testimony did the day before, to the Declaration of Independence, the Constitutional Convention. In her short press conference, she cited George Mason, Gouverneur Morris. She's putting more words in her statement about 1787 than she is about 2019. Secondly, she briefly but clearly stated the charge against the president, saying the president abused his power for his own personal political benefit at the expense of our national security. That's just a few words. That's not hundreds of pages. Very, very crisply done. And third, she lamented that the president's actions, in her words, leave us no choice, that there's nothing else we can do but this. That's what she did do, but I thought equally telling is what she chose not to do. Up to this point, the vast majority of Speaker Pelosi's public comments have included her saying, this is a sorrowful process. This is a solemn process. This is a prayerful process. One of those words has been used virtually every time she's spoken about impeachment going back to months and months ago. This time, she shifted it somewhat. She did mention that, sadly, she had to do this. But she said, I think for the first time, she said, we are proceeding with confidence and humility. Confidence is not a word she's used in any of this up to this point. They're definitely building rhetorically on the momentum. Also, something she did not do. She did not even acknowledge any of the distractive arguments that have been brought up. She didn't mention Hunter Biden. She didn't mention him, even to knock them down. Completely ignored them, similar to the way that Adam Schiff completely ignored Devin Nunes in the hearings. And then third, Speaker Pelosi did not lay out specific articles of impeachment. Yes, she said the president abused his power, and later on she did use the phrase abuse of power again, strongly signaling that is an article of impeachment under high crimes and misdemeanors. But she did not present this is the roadmap for us to pursue on things like obstruction of justice or contempt of Congress or even bribery. All she laid out was, we are moving forward with articles. Over to you, Judiciary.
David, really important question arising from your comments just now. Should parents be naming their children Gouverneur again? Should we let that name die with the 18th century?
I think as a middle name, it's a good choice because you give the child the option to choose it later in life, which I predict none will.
I say I'm pro Gouverneur. I think we should be bringing it back.
You also get to use Goo as your nickname,
or Goovy.
Or Goovy. Goovy.
Margaret, you don't have any children named Gouverneur, but you did write a piece, as David alluded to this week, about what happens now and what the sort of with Molly Reynolds, what the next phase is. We saw a little bit of the next phase, but what are you expecting now with this initial hearing and then Pelosi's comments? Do we all just go in a back room and write articles of impeachment, or is there there's apparently a hearing scheduled now for Monday. So what should we expect?
So it has been announced that the House Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing this coming Monday, December 9th, where counsel from both the House Intelligence Committee and the House Judiciary Committee will be presenting evidence to the members in this impeachment inquiry. And so that's the next step here. More broadly, I mean, one thing which we sort of saw this, yes, the other day in the first Judiciary Committee hearing, there are so many members on the Judiciary Committee, much, much bigger than the Intelligence Committee. So I think just by sheer virtue of the numbers, these hearings will be quite unwieldy. They will have that vibe to them. There's no question. And as Molly and I point out in our piece, the members of the Judiciary Committee are much more sort of ideologically extreme than the Intelligence Committee. So I do think we will see more of the same type of thing that we saw just the other day with the first Judiciary Committee hearing. So, and you know, it'll be very interesting, I think, to see these councils, presumably both the Democratic Council and the Republican Council, make their presentations. It'll be interesting to see what questions the members ask of these different lawyers. I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. I think it will be a kind of interesting new step in this process that I just haven't seen yet.
Susan, if you were Chairman Nadler and Ranking Member Collins, and you had the opportunity to have these committee counsel in front of you, what would be the specific aspects of the record that you would say, okay, this is really my opportunity to bring out in a kind of vivid way, either that we haven't said yet or that really kind of warrants a foot stomp?
Certainly the sort of putting laser focus on the core of the impeachable conduct here when it comes to Ukraine, that the President of the United States conditioned official acts on investigations for political purposes. And everything else we're hearing, all of the rest of the story is really about context. It's about definition. It's about understanding what the president meant when he said certain words, understanding how people would have received certain indications, right? You need all of that sort of background. But the core really is using the official powers of his office in order to obtain political benefit. And that's something that is well supported, demonstrated by the record, that the innocent explanations are not available, are not supported by the record, and sort of the importance, I think, of underscoring that, and also of underscoring a little bit how close this came to working. That we were just a few days away from the president of Ukraine making an announcement on CNN. And if that had happened, we would be in a totally different news cycle and it would be almost impossible to disentangle all of this stuff. And that what we have seen here is an instance of presidential abuse that came this close to working, but for one person being willing to write down a whistleblower complaint and say this isn't right. And the fragility of this and the consequences to our system had it actually worked, how corrosive, how dangerous the sort of the long-term structural damage of this. And I think that's important, one, to convey the stakes to the public, and two, to make clear the choice the Republicans are making in deciding essentially to put their fingers in their ears and their head in the sand and pretend as though that's not what happened, or even worse, to pretend as though it's actually okay.
Scott, so one thing I was thinking as I was listening to Susan just now was, you know, you could really use this hearing to kind of orally write the articles of impeachment. You've got committee counsel there who know the record pretty intimately and who are actually going to write it. And so you could have the sort of oral, almost like an editorial conversation with them about what aspects of the record will and won't support what charges. Is that a good, I don't want to use the word glibly, but is that a good show, or is that the kind of thing that should go on in the back room? In other words, is this a kind of good opportunity for a sort of oral markup and a kind of drafting session, or should they use it for something else?
That's a really difficult question. It depends upon how they can structure it, the level of control versus the majority versus the minority, how many interruptions you're going to deal with in terms of the format. My inclination to some extent would be to focus on getting a product that carries the day, to take the long record that the Intelligence Committee has developed along with the Mueller investigation and the other elements that come in and really try and distill it down into something that both makes the case and makes it in a way that carries the day with at least a substantial portion of the public and hopefully with members of Congress as well. This is the last chance to really sit and try and sell this in a way that any Republican may sign on to or that people who are skeptical may sign on to. It's not looking very optimistic at this point that that's a real possibility, but I think that it's in their interest to really explore that and discuss that. And again, that means structuring these things in a way that may mean making some compromises to bring people on board. For those reasons, backdoor process may be a little bit easier. If we see them do a much more public performative process, I suspect that will mean that they have decided they're not going to get any Republican votes and instead they're going to use it as a case to make justify their actions to the public more than try and win Republicans over internally.
David, so wrap us up. As you look at this, they have suggested they want to get this all done before the Christmas recess. That is not a lot of days. So you're having a hearing on Monday. You're going to have a markup, which means you have articles drafted, right, that you're going to distribute probably later in the week. Then you're going to have a Judiciary Committee vote. And then you got to have a floor debate and a floor vote. It's going to be a heck of a couple weeks in the House of Representatives. What are you expecting as you look forward to it?
It would be tight, but it can be done, especially because those articles of impeachment, we shouldn't fool ourselves. They are already written. They are probably being revised and tweaked here and there, probably scouted out with a few key people to judge. Will this word present you a problem? Would this word be better to communicate the same idea, but with different words? So I think it is moving that quickly. In this whole process, we've been talking about the strategy of Pelosi and how the hearings would go out versus waiting for subpoenas and all this. We have forgotten one very chaotic variable in how this plays out, and that is Donald J. Trump. I mean, even right before we're recording this, when Nancy Pelosi, after her statement, was asked, you know, do you hate the president? And she responded forcefully, I don't hate anybody. In fact, this is about the Constitution. I pray for the president. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that, very forcefully arguing that this is not about hatred. Well, of course, what happens? Within minutes, Donald J. Trump responds, tweeting, Nancy Pelosi just had a nervous fit. She says she prays for the president. I don't believe her, not even close. Help the homeless in your district, Nancy. We don't know exactly how much Donald Trump will unravel as this process goes forward, but I guarantee you there will be something he does that makes it harder for moderate Republicans to keep supporting him on these lines. That is something that's hard to predict. All we have to do is think, how will the Democrats lay out their strategy to, in a sense, take advantage of that chaotic variable going forward?
We're going to leave it there. Margaret, David, Susan, Scott, thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You need merch. We have lots of new merch. We've got it at thelawfarestore.com. We've got pens. We've got notebooks. We've got awesome socks. Everything you need this holiday season for the Lawfare branded fanatic is there, thelawfarestore.com. You also should share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook, on Twitter, whatever podcast distribution service you use. You should leave us a rating and a review. And of course, you should post us to Pinterest, where we are woefully underrepresented. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this episode is Jacob Schultz. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan, who showed up on Rational Security to tell her origin story and about her exploits as a reporter in China. And of course, thanks for listening.
Hold up. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.